thinking big thoughts, so you don't have to.
Now it's time for...
Here's John Williams.
Some sunshine. I do this. I torture myself. I look at the back page of the Tribune. I have an app on my phone. It projects out 7 to 10 days of weather. They can give you one icon. Clouds or thunderstorms or sunshine. And I'm seeing way too many clouds. Literally and figuratively on the horizon. But the back page of the Tribune today wasn't like that. The back page of the Tribune was like sunshine and hot, and it's going to be like summer this week. And then I looked at my phone, and it had a bunch of little cloud thunderstorm icons on for much of the week. And it can either be one or the other. Even though the weather can be both, the icon can only be one thing. And it tortures me. It literally follows me during the day, those clouds. Even when it might not indeed be cloudy. But I let this populate my thoughts, and I'm going to have a good or bad week sometimes just thinking about it, even though that might not reflect the actual weather.
I just think that the weather app has had better years. It's really not accurate.
That
most
is
of the
so
time.
True.
I've reached the point I won't even look at the weather anymore because I know it will make me upset.
I know. And you know, and here's the, you know, hey, listen, if you're a weather app, I know it's not easy, right? I was at the Cubs game yesterday. At the Cubs game, it was sunny, blue skies, cool breezes. It was muggy. It was rainy. And that was just the third inning. It was just back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. You get up, you walk under the thing for shelter because it's starting to rain. By the time you get there, it stops raining. You go back out. That's the way it was at the Cubs game yesterday. How about that Javi Baez home run? Wow. Got home and was able to watch the White Sox. I thought almost pull the game out because the Sox, with Eloy Jimenez up to bat in the eighth inning, he hit a ball so hard. It stayed about 12 feet off the ground the whole way to center field, and the center fielder was coming in on it, and then the thing just kept going like a frisbee, like one of those golf shots. It was ruled an error. He should have caught it, but it was a very tricky ball because no ball has ever been hit that way, such as Eloy Jimenez. Enough about the White Sox. So there I was at Wrigley Field eating a hot dog. I went up to get the hot dog. Brendan and I got there real early. We thought, let's just spend the day there. And so we were there about an hour and 20 minutes before the game even started. And you know, you get a 10% discount on food if you get there that early, and I'm no fool. So
you live two blocks away.
Yeah.
So you went an hour and 20 minutes early?
Yes. To be honest with you, I thought that the game...
I knew it.
I thought I was going to be there 20 minutes early.
I knew it.
And as we were watching it get to game time, I thought, wow, they're still raking the infield. They're going to have to hurry up because the game needs to start in 10 minutes. And then I silently... went, oh, I've got another hour. But I didn't want to share that with Brenda because she really wanted to get there early and just kind of enjoy the day outside and fresh air and all that. So we're enjoying our 10% off on the hot dogs. But here's what I wanted to tell you. When you go to Wrigley Field, and it's probably this way at Sox Park too, but it just seems to me like what they should sell are foods that are not only fun and delicious and all that stuff, but are easier to eat. I went to get a hot dog. And they have what they say is the special hot dog. It's a foot long. And I didn't know anything about it, but either the lady selling it or Brenda, one of them said, boy, I hear this hot dog is really good. It's the special hot dog.
You're saying like hot dog.
Right.
It's just, I've never heard you say hot dog before. It's said how? It's a hot dog. Not like hot cuisine, a hot dog.
Aren't we from Chicago
I'm
now?
I'm sorry. I've never heard you say hot dog.
I don't think I'm saying hot dog.
I think you are. Anyway, miss you.
So I got this wiener that's about a foot long, and here's what it is. It's a foot long hot dog, and what they do is they crumble potato chips on it, then spread ranch dressing on it in a thick drizzle, and then put sport peppers. And when the lady served it to me, I didn't know what it was going to be, but I was ready for the special hot dog. And it comes to me, and now I didn't want to tell her, oh, I'm not eating that. So I... take the $12 hot dog, and then as I'm walking away, Brenda looks at me and she says, you're not going to eat that, are you? And I said, not even close. I'm not eating this. What is this? Who in what kitchen did some culinary scientist go, all right, we'll crush a handful of potato chips, put ranch and sport peppers? That's like
a six-year-old kitchen.
Exactly.
That's who made that.
Is Timmy available? Because I don't like this and I want my money back. And I actually felt bad because the lady who was selling it to me, there wasn't a long line, but with us being there several hours before the first pitch, and I know she could see me walking away, but I walked over to the garbage can, and I'm scraping the hot part of the hot dog into the garbage can. Because I'm like, it's a ridiculous mess, and nobody wants that. It looks like a mistake.
Remember Ray Burris, pitcher for the Cubs?
Sure.
Okay, so when I was, 10, we're at a game and had great seats. Ray Burris was pitching, and we were sitting right behind his parents.
Nice.
Or right in front. What are they? Yeah. And, you know, they started talking to us. It was clear who they were.
Yeah.
You know, I was a big baseball fan as a little kid. So Mrs. Burris buys me a hot dog.
Is this a similar story?
In those days, they all came with mustard.
Well, yeah.
They didn't give you packets. They were...
Well, you're in Chicago.
They're prepackaged with mustard.
Uh-huh.
And in those days, I didn't eat mustard. So I had to pretend to eat it and stuffed it in my jacket pocket.
Oh, seriously?
Yeah, I wouldn't eat it. I couldn't eat mustard.
Steve, I don't eat ketchup, but if Mrs.
I know.
Burris gave me a hot dog... with ketchup on it, and she's sitting there.
Just couldn't do it.
Smiling.
I had to hide it.
As this great benefactor of kindness. What a gesture. And then you put it in your pocket?
Had to hide it from my favorite pitcher's mom.
Were you happy to see her, or was that a hot dog with mustard in your pocket? So you actually put it, there goes the inside of your pocket.
I stuffed it in, yeah, right.
Wow. Well, we stuck around.
Okay, back to your story. It's now 2 hours before game time.
Why didn't they ask you what you wanted on your hot dog first?
Because it's the special hot dog. It's the special... I did say hot dog, didn't I? It's the way they make this... It wasn't a hot dog. It was the special hot dog. It's a kind of thing.
It sounds really bad.
It's evidently a real big thing with some folks, but I'm telling you, eating it was... I got a lot of the debris off, but it was still just kind of a mess. And when you're eating that on your knees in a seat at Wrigley Field, it's kind of weird.
Ranch sweat dressing.
Yeah, right. John, I got this wiener that's about a foot long. Nick D had a heart attack describing it. That's all of the food there. That's all of the food there. I mean, yeah, you don't expect any of it's going to be healthy. You know it's going to be hopefully tasty, but it wasn't easy to eat. And just looking down at that, I thought, oh boy, all right, I'm going to have to eat this thing. I'm reading a book whose author I think I will interview. You know, I don't want to sometimes put things on that are completely irrelevant to all of us, but sometimes you enjoy something so much that you think, well, if I tell you this story, you'll probably enjoy it too. I'm reading The World's Fastest Man, The Extraordinary Life of Cyclist Major Taylor. What? It's written by a guy named Michael Cranish, who is an investigative reporter at Washington Post. He's written books about Donald Trump and Mitt Romney and Thomas Jefferson. And Fastest Man in the World, he writes about this guy named Major Taylor. This book is so good. I literally read it while walking from the L stop to the radio station.
That's not safe.
It's really not. But I think, well, I've got 13 minutes here that I could, and twice a day, I've got almost a half an hour of reading time. So I put it up to my nose and walk along, which is weird too, because after my eye surgery, I can't see that well anyway. So
you know where the river is, right?
When my ankles get wet, I know to veer right. In Fastest Man in the World, he writes about Major Taylor, who is a young man whose life includes a lot of time spent in Chicago and Peoria and Indianapolis. He was a professional competitive bicycle racer at a time when that was a really big thing in the late 1800s. Teddy Roosevelt's going to be president soon, just to give you an idea about the time frame. Bike racing was bigger than baseball. Bigger crowds, more press time spent in the newspaper. Folks knew who their favorite racers were in bicycle racing across the country, the way you might know who NASCAR drivers are, they knew bicycle racers for a number of reasons. Principally, the whole business of cycle racing was booming because the bicycle industry was booming. Because until right about then, say late 1800s, before the use of automobiles, right, we didn't have cars on the roads, we didn't have very good roads, but people got around on horses. So bicycles were a novelty to start. Think of the scene in Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, where Robert Redford and Catherine Ross, no, Paul Newman and Catherine Ross are riding around on the bicycle. They were a novelty, but they became more affordable and were eventually seen as a way to get around. This would be faster transportation. A horse would cost you around $200 and almost that much to keep for a year. It eventually dies. A bicycle could be had for less. It didn't drop manure everywhere. They had thousands of tons of manure just piling up in New York all of the time. Bicycles didn't do that. Cycling clubs propped up across the United States. This is a whole era that's really just passed us by without us having much recollection of it. But in the bicycling clubs that were popping up across the country, they would include padded rooms where people would learn to ride. Sometimes they had that great big front wheel and the small back wheel, and you'd get way up there. Sometimes not, but it was dangerous for a public that was learning to ride for the first time and didn't know how. In New York, there was a grand ballroom where the riders would dress fashionably and pedal slowly around the obstacles on the floor. In the first balcony, an orchestra played music to which they all rode, sometimes in formation. And on the second balcony, high society would socialize and applaud at the entertainment down below. Bicycles were very much a fashionable thing. The problem was it was still expensive, and the bikes were heavy, and they had hard rubber tires. Plus, there were not smooth paved roads in the United States. In fact, the movement to create paved streets in towns and from city to city was propelled by wheelman clubs. Paved roads would make it easier to ride bicycles on. That's why we got them. Oh, we had an interstate highway system eventually, but you want to go from Washington to Philadelphia? You want to go from Louisville to somewhere else? You want to go from Chicago to, I don't know what a neighboring city would have been back then, but a paved road would be nice, and they were lobbying the President of the United States and local lawmakers to pave roads for bicycles. Races would attract thousands, sometimes tens of thousands of people. They had a six-day race that the author chronicles that to see who could ride the most in a six-day marathon. It was held at Madison Square Garden, and it sold out every day. The garden was filled with smoke. The riders rode to exhaustion, most dropping out. The arena was so filled with smoke, the people that would come at Madison Square Garden to watch the bicycle riders go round and around and around, people keeping track of how many laps they made. It was a six-day marathon to see who could go the farthest. Folks would fill the arena day and night. It was 24 hours a day. But the spectators would smoke pipes and cigarettes and cigars, and the place became so filled with smoke the riders couldn't see across the track. Was not healthy in any manner. And into this story, I mean, that's bicycle racing, but what really propels the story are a couple of individuals. And the world's fastest man, that's the title of the book, was this man named Major Taylor, who, while arguably the best sprinter in America, was black. And post-Civil War Jim Crow laws kept him out of a lot of the races. Kept him from even going to the YMCA to train. Clubs wouldn't allow him in. He was pushed down by fellow white racers in events that he was allowed to race in. In one event, nearing the finish line, a spectator threw a bucket of cold water on him. It kept him from winning. After one race he finished second in, the rider who took third choked him into unconsciousness. This was sort of the environment. He was really the Jackie Robinson of bicycle racing. He was good-natured, he was well-educated, he was wise. Folks who weren't blinded by prejudice really liked him, and he was the beneficiary of some promoters who were white and were determined to see him succeed, both for his benefit and for theirs. So what you're learning is not only what the country was like 100-plus years ago, but, and I'll just finish my thought with this observation, you know, we say, well, there's racism, and it was worse back then, and it's almost sort of theoretical. You talk about the concept of racism, but when you see it exercised on an individual, when you hear the quotes from the President of the United States, who said that race really isn't a problem in the South, and the Southerners are very kind to the blacks down there, and they'll get their turn. That's the president of the United States. It really gives you pause. And then to hear the individuals, how they treated this Major Taylor guy. I mean, it just feels very contemporaneous, and it's just fascinating. So you're rooting for the world's fastest man. It's Michael Cranish's book. It's really interesting. It's 122. John, why is it okay for Fortune 500 companies to pay zero taxes while making billions off the U.S. consumer? I am totally okay with our taxes paying for our children's higher education. I'm okay with free college education the way it is high school in America, but that's not what we're talking about. It's 129. We'll pause and then talk a little more about this and get your opinion on it. Is this going to make you vote for Bernie or not, or Elizabeth Warren? It's 129 on WGN. By the way, Stephen, we were at the Hometown Voices tour stop in Geneva for Swedish Days yesterday. Pardon me, that would have been Saturday. Griffin and I were out there with Marlene and Rick. Ernie, our engineer, was out there. And we had a really, we had about as nice a time as you can have. It was just really fun. Good food, good people, lots of memories. You know, one of the interesting revelations to me was how many people came and said that they do listen to this show every day, but often in the evening or the next day via podcast.
So maybe they get it for after the corrections.
A more dedicated host might go back and fine comb the thing, but no, I don't do that.
That's the beauty of it. It's
warts
live.
And all.
Right.
So thank you all for listening. And a woman came up to me, and she had in an envelope a bunch of photographs from the Kathy and Judy convention in 2001, I think, was the year.
You showed me the pictures.
Which are now available on all of my social media platforms.
Did you get approval? Because there's one of us, not you or me,
right,
who might suffer the most.
I don't know which picture that would be. Lou Manfredini.
Oh, I wouldn't say that.
Oh, boy, what a bad choice. And really, that's the thing.
Did you post the one of Lou?
I believe, Elif, did we post the one of Lou Manfredini as well?
Yes, sir.
Yes, yes, yes.
Oh, see?
Think early Friends or Seinfeld, when men would wear their pants up too high and tuck everything in with a thin belt. Lou had that look going on.
I was thinking SpongeBob, but yeah, those others would work too.
I love that comparison.
It totally is that. In fact, Griffin and I were talking about it afterwards, and he said, you know, like women's fashions from 2000, 2001 travel. If you watch an old episode of Seinfeld, Elaine still looks comfortable or fashionable, and it does work for the cast of Friends. But if you look at the men's fashions from early episodes of Friends or Seinfeld, just as an example, and these pictures bear it out, you just go, oh, no. Oh, no.
And with social media now, you have to get approval. That's the thing.
Well, I thought the approval would be her photographs. So I thought.
Oh, so she approved of a really bad picture of Lou.
I think so. Elif, can we play just a little bit of that conversation we had on Saturday?
My name's Paige.
Paige, where are you from?
Geneva, Illinois.
Thanks for stopping by. So nice to meet you.
It's nice to meet you, too, for the second time.
We met at a Kathy and Judy convention?
Yes, in 2001.
You've just handed me pictures. Oh, Lord. And so this is 2001.
Yes, and you look exactly the same.
I do not. And you know what's just disheartening to me is that I'm wearing a lime green turtleneck. Oh, my gosh. What was I thinking? And I know if I wore it to the Kathy and Judy convention, I thought that was a good look.
Very trendy in 2001.
Oh, my God. So then there's me, Kathy and Judy. And then here's a picture of the panel of us where Kathy and Judy, our longtime and much loved hosts here at the radio station, would put all of us men up. Although Mary Vandeville and Judy Pilak, some of them would be up there, too. But a lot of the guys that worked with them would be up on this panel. So there's Dave Ennett with a sweater tucked in. And Steve Bertrand with a turtleneck that's about to swallow him.
Yeah, that was a good look at the time.
I miss turtlenecks a little bit.
So that's gone.
You can still wear them.
No, I don't think I can because someone would post it.
But they're still in style. Well, they're back, I should say.
I think they're in style for women more than men.
So that, you know, it's funny because Lou looks, it's kind of funny. Steve, Dave Ennett, we all look kind of funny. We look products of that era. But nobody looks sillier than me with my incandescent lime green body hug and turtleneck.
Well, it's very nice of you to say, even though it's not true.
How's that?
Well, no one looks worse than Lou.
Well, this should be a vote. We should do one of those Twitter votes or something like that. But it'll be the news click. Who looks worse? Steve, John, Dave?
You know the beauty of it? Lou probably cares the least, too.
Yeah, well, that's the beauty of Lou.
Right.
I'm WGN King John on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. The pictures are on all of those sites, Ella?
Yes.
Wisely?
You wanted me to put them on Pinterest, too, but I did not oblige.
So, you know, when you go on these trips, right, we have Facebook pages and you post pictures.
I do.
I kind of stopped posting pictures of people.
I know. You are right about this. I don't care about.
We took six group pictures and I sent them to everyone because I know they'd all look good in one of them. Right? I mean.
But you're afraid about posting them because somebody might not like the picture?
Or they might not love the picture, so.
Well, but that's why you have a closed group, right?
Yeah.
I mean, that satisfies that concern, doesn't it? Largely, anyway? Well, maybe not legally.
Then you just think you look stupid in front of fewer people.
Well, but I mean, so that's... I created a Facebook group for one of my travels, and it was one of your trips. I believe it was the last trip we took for you, and then you created a separate one, and the only way to get into it was to be...
accepted.
To petition and be accepted in, and which the travelers would, and you would govern that. I thought they should just go out to the general public and then be good promotion for your travels and our listenership. But maybe that's not, considerate to the people that are in the group. So I don't know what the, right thinking on that is.
Some people don't like to broadcast that they're away from home.
Right,
or that
they don't think it's a good picture and they wish you hadn't posted it. And you can't ask every single person to sign off on every single photo. So you're probably right, I guess. But I've been a public person for so long, I don't even think twice about it. Hey, John, does that book explain why the first bicycles that you were reading about were built up so high with the front wheels so much bigger? Yeah, you know the kind they're talking about. And it does not. If it does, I haven't read that. But eventually they do get in the bicycles that look like we know now, with two wheels about the same size, closer to the ground. And the story about that's kind of interesting, because they had the real tall bicycles. And the one thing about the bicycles back then, where they were made of steel, maybe wood, and the tires were hard, thick rubber. There was no inner tube. And there was a doctor, I think he was in Indiana, and his child, when he would get into bicycle races with his friends, could never win. He just wasn't as strong as the other kids or fast. And his father wanted his son to have more fun riding the bicycle, maybe a competitive edge. So he sent away to Sweden and had them ship him some rubber. He had to go to Sweden to get rubber, I guess. It wasn't commonly used. We didn't have automobiles yet. Rubber wasn't a common textile or fabric or stuff in the United States. So the people in Sweden sent him some rubber. And then he cut strips of the rubber into long strips, like long hot dogs. And then he glued the sides together and made a long tube. And then he got a air pump somehow, and he filled that tube with air, sewed or sealed the ends with glue. He put a hole in it and put a baby bottle nipple there and made the first pneumatic inner tube. And then he wrapped that around a wooden wheel. And then the bicycle, and then he covered that in cloth. So now he has invented the first lightweight bicycle tire. And he made that for his son, and his son was able to win the bicycle races now. His last name, this doctor, was Dr. Dunlop. There are Dunlop tires and tennis balls to this day, starting with that one child who wanted a competitive edge racing his bicycle. It's all in that book called The World's Fastest Man. Where are we, Aleph? I want to go to the Bernie Sanders story. Let's jump into that quickly, can we? I said 1.2. Bernie Sanders is submitting legislation that will cancel $1.6 trillion in student loan, undergraduate and graduate debt for approximately 45 million people. This is just so blatant. You almost got to admire it. I mean, here's how you buy votes. You tell 45 million people, come with me and I'll make your debt go away.
That was his platform last time, was it not?
There was a lot of that. I don't remember this per se. I suppose this was in there. And I know Hillary had an aggressive student education financing program. She was going to make, I think, junior college is free. I think you should make at least the first 2 years of college free, the same way you make high school free. But Bernie's going, well, forget that. If you went to graduate school or undergraduate, if you got your doctorate at a private school and you owe $400,000, that happens. It would go away the day this legislation is signed. Bernie doesn't have to be president for this. This is him as a senator. If you have student debt of any kind, it would be canceled the second the legislation is signed into law. Sanders said we're going to forgive student debt in this country. If we don't change it, we will have a generation with a lower standard of living than their parents, more in debt, lower wages than their parents, unable to buy the house they desire. The broader proposal includes subsidies to reduce the cost of tuition and fees for low-income students. And how's he going to pay for this? He said he's going to tax Wall Street. He's going to raise $2.2 trillion to pay for the program. Here's the last two paragraphs that are at CNN right now. It'll include a 0.5% tax, half a percent of a tax on stock trades. So for every $100 worth of stocks you trade, it'll cost you 50 cents. 100 bucks, 50 cents. A 0.1% fee on bonds, and a 0.005% fee on derivatives. Sanders says he'll get $2.4 trillion over 10 years with that alone. He also has a Wall Street speculation tax. And now here's the last thing I'll read you, and then tell me what you think. Congress voted to bail out the crooks on Wall Street, he said. You remember that? They provided $700 billion in federal loans, and in addition, trillions of dollars in zero or very low interest loans. So I think the time is now for Wall Street to repay that obligation to the American people. Wall Street got the break. Now Wall Street has to pay back by bailing out any student with debt in this country. Okay, break, says Elif. Tell me what you think of that. 312-981-7200.
This is a misprint. No. It's two tickets, right?
No, 20.
Are you serious?
20 tickets.
I'm not taking the fall for this if you're wrong.
You're good.
All right, here goes.
Yeah.
To celebrate summer and your family's tradition of loving baseball, WGN Radio has the mother of all White Sox ticket giveaways. Not one, not two, not five, 20 tickets in to see a White Sox game in July. And a suite to put you in. You'll enjoy a Skybox suite for 20 plus food. How could you win? Tune into the Rookon Show with Anna DeVlantis today. They'll give you clues on when to tune in to the Steve Cochran Show the following morning. Cochran will take callers, give away four tickets to an upcoming game, and qualify you to win the suite for 20 on July 28th. For complete details, including official rules, at WGNRadio.com/contest. Rokon has your first clues tonight at 5:40 from the flagship home of the White Sox, 720 WGN. 720, right?
You jump into the car with your briefcase, rushing to an important business meeting, hit the garage door remote, and nothing happens. Now what?
Green Tea Services. Service to a
green tea.
Hi, it's Tonya Khoury for my family business, Green Tea Services. Right now, we have a garage door maintenance special. Our trained technicians come out and adjust the springs, check the cables, inspect the rollers, tighten hinges, and give your door and opener a complete lubrication. All for just $47.
Service to a
green tea.
Garage doors fail when you least expect it. Don't get stuck in or out of your garage. Call for our $47 garage door maintenance special. Call Green Tea now for details. 800-5-GREEN-TEA.
Green Tea Services. Service to a
green
tea. 800-5-GREEN-TEA.
800-5-GREEN-TEA. Or greenteaservices.com.
Hey, John, there's a velodrome in Indiana named after that Major Taylor. Didn't know that. Thank you. John, I can't find the pictures on Facebook. What am I doing wrong? Well, first of all, it may be your advantage, but we'll double check if you are following the right page. I'm WGN King John on Facebook. Make sure you like WGN King John on Facebook to see, well, some pictures, and then hilarity will ensue. Is Chicago's America's best baseball town? We got two teams, heated crosstown rivalry, some exciting things going on out there. Makes you want to get a baseball and run outside and play catch, but oh, wait, you can't because your shoulder joint or your elbow hurts. Maybe your knees aren't doing their part. There's this place called the Joint Relief Institute. They're ready to get you back in the game. Carefully used digital imaging will show their doctors and technicians where your joints compromise, and then they put a lubricant into that spot to ease your pain, to get you playing catch or golfing or gardening or just going about your day pain-free. This is a quick procedure, and it's almost surely covered by your insurance or Medicare, and they've got a specialist to make sure you get the maximum coverage and maximum pain relief. Check out their website, jointreliefinstitute.com, jointreliefinstitute.com. Or just call. They've got two locations. It's the same phone number for either spot, 708-888-0000, 708-888-0000, as in zero pain. Hey, Brian, you're on WGN Radio. What can I do for you?
Hi, John. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I don't usually call in, but and so if I'm a little nervous, forgive me. I'm so incensed by what seems to be this sideways logic in this legislation, or at least promise of legislation by Biden that I had to call. There seems to be, in general, in my mind, a certain lack of integrity to signing an agreement, a document saying that I will repay my college tuition. I put two daughters through schools, and we put them through to schools, first off, that, you know, we felt we could afford, not schools that we, you know, wanted to be able to have on their resume. And I repaid their student loans at some financial hardship. And now they're proposing that this large number, and I don't remember your exact quotes on numbers, that they be forgiven. And again, seems that there's a lack of integrity in this country. They signed a document saying, I will repay.
Yeah.
And in a lot of cases, they went to schools that they couldn't otherwise have afforded. And I guess I lived within my means.
Yeah, well, I don't think you're alone. And the number you're thinking of is $1.6 trillion. As much as I don't like high interest rates, and we can all be mad at banks or whoever it is that lent the money. I mean, you know, there's some businesses out there that have more sympathy in the public than others, but they aren't bad people. Those are legitimate businesses that we just said $1.6 trillion that you all are owed. We're not going to pay it now. Thanks for the phone call, Brian. I appreciate you joining us. Bob wanted to say something, too. Hey, Bob, you're on the air. Hi, Bob.
Thank you. Hi, thank you. Yeah, I guess there's 2 points. First of all, I lived in a modest home, although I was a high earner, because I wanted to put away the money for the kids. I had three children. I put away $600,000 into a 529 account, and some of that was simply growth. Because I took advantage of a growing stock market in there. But now my kids are not taking any loans, and I think it's responsibility of the parents also to put aside that money.
Yeah.
And it seems very unfair that now I could have lived in a McMansion where all my friends live.
Yeah, no kidding. Yeah.
You know, it's good for you, but it's hard for me to imagine that most people in a middle class income could put away $600,000. I mean, that's fantastic on your part. I just don't think you're typical.
$600,000.
That's a lot of money.
You oversaved.
It is a lot of money.
Send him to ISU.
It's $50,000 a year for most schools, and you have 4 years. And so there you are. Now, my daughter got a scholarship from the Army. She's going to be an Army nurse. And so that freed up some money for the two boys.
Yeah, no, that's all good. I'm just thinking of the $600,000. I mean, were you living under a bridge?
No.
No, I get your point. I get your point. We're out of time, but I appreciate the phone call. Forget the $600,000 part, because you are an outlier on that.
I mean, that's fantastic.
People don't have that to retire on, let alone save for their kids to pay. But I also understand, if nothing else, he's making a fair math point, isn't he, Steve? He reduced his standard of living so he'd have that much money. He could have had a nicer house and another car.
Right.
Chose not to do that. We'll talk more about this next week. Ray Kaplan's going to come by and we'll get her opinion about that. But really, if you're going to do that for people who are having trouble paying off their student loans, how about people that are having trouble paying off their cars and mortgages? I mean, that's legitimate too, right?
Well, I think there are more programs to help people having difficulty with their mortgages than there are student loans. You know, you can declare bankruptcy and get relief from your mortgage. You cannot do that.
So you think this is a good idea?
Huh? I don't know that it's a good idea, but something needs to be done badly. I mean, the federal government is making money on student loan interest payments. That shouldn't be done.
Thinking big thoughts so you don't have to.
Living.
Here's John Williams.
We're in the Allstate Skyline Studio, weekdays 1 to 3, Saturdays 10 to noon. This past Saturday, we were in Geneva, Illinois for their Swedish Days. The Hometown Voices Tour stopped in Geneva. We had a great time out there and took some really groovy pictures. We posted them on my social media pages. Wherever you go, I'm WGN King John. WGN King John on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And there you'll see pictures that actually one of the listeners shared with us from 2001 to the Kathy and Judy convention. The fashions of the men are worth signing up for Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram if you're not already. You will enjoy that. Or be shocked. You know, don't look at them while you're driving.
We haven't heard from SpongeBob, have we?
That would be Lou Manfredini, our Mr. Fix-It, who you want to see if you want to see a man tuck everything he owns into a thin belt and then hike up his pants above his waist, you want to see this picture. So, if Lou were listening in the last hour, I know we would have heard from him by now for sure. Okay, so this Jussie Smollett story is back in the news. I call it Smollett 3.0 because there was the first story. Then there was more the story about what really happened. And we thought we were done with that. Everybody with a bitter taste in their mouth. And then this lady, Sheila O'Brien, the former judge, surfaces. And it's Smollett 3.0. This lady is in our studio. Sheila O'Brien, welcome to the studio.
Thanks.
How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
Is it fair to say that you are singularly perhaps the reason that we might have a special prosecutor, we're going to have a special prosecutor, and Smollett may yet go to jail?
That is, well,
you were about to say that is true.
That is true, that I probably am the singular reason that you have a special prosecutor.
So tell me a little bit about yourself. You're not a sitting judge now. You're retired.
Correct. Been retired since 2011, and that's been great. Love retirement, and practiced law, and was a public defender, and became a judge at a rather young age, and came to Chicago, was a judge here, ran for the appellate court, and retired after 16 years on the appellate court.
16 years on the appellate court.
Right.
So what does an appellate court judge do? What kind of cases did you see?
Well, you know how you hear on TV, we're going to appeal this, so it goes to the appellate court. And the appellate court is the group that we're not Monday morning quarterbacks. We don't retry the case. We see if the laws were applied evenly and fairly. So not was the outcome correct necessarily, but were the laws applied fairly?
Not do you agree with the outcome.
Correct.
But even if you disagreed, it's that judge's opinion, and as long as he conducted business properly, then it stands.
Correct.
So is that why you particularly have a vested interest in this? For instance, well, answer this question before you answer that. I don't know what the question is, because he wasn't tried. I was about to ask you if you agreed with the original sentencing, but that didn't happen, did it?
Is it the why me question? Why you, Sheila O'Brien? What got you involved in this?
Well, that's another interview. I want to cut to the Smollett case, if I may.
Sure.
I mean, for instance, do you think that he's telling the truth that he was actually mugged by a couple of guys downtown, or do you think that he staged the whole thing?
I have not taken a look in his eyes to see if he's telling the truth. It doesn't sound very plausible, does it?
Most people don't believe it.
No.
Okay, but again, that's
not my issue. That's not what I was about.
Really? So as bad as we all felt about that, you wouldn't be here today unless what?
If Mr. Smollett, I think the thing that got me off the couch was the court file was sealed. So unbeknownst to everybody, the case was on an emergency motion brought into court. No one was notified. The arresting officers were not notified. The press wasn't notified. The cases were all dismissed, and the court file was sealed. It's like, wait a minute. The court file sealed, and now we don't know what happened. And then Mr. Smollett went out and said, I'm innocent, and I've been the victim, and yada, yada. And that, I think, was what got me off the couch. The process. Would the janitor in this building or at 26th Street have gotten the same deal? Been treated that way? Probably not.
Yeah. And that way includes the fact that they were almost sweeping it under the rug quietly, right, dismissing this case or charges against him.
Not quietly. I mean, not kind of. Yeah, quietly, totally quietly. And sealing a court file so that you or I can't go in and see what happened.
So then this is a problem with, I mean, but Smollett will take it if he can get it, but he's not the decider. It's this Judge Tooman that decided to conduct the case. Or is your problem more with Kim Fox's office?
No, Tooman wasn't involved in the original part of it. Tooman was the judge I appeared in front of, and he is the person who appointed a special process.
Got it.
It's the actions of the state's attorney's office here that were troubling, because the law provides if you recuse yourself from a case, You have to get somebody else to do the case.
Talk to me about that recusal process and what did and didn't happen here.
The statute, the laws of Illinois provide, if you're the state's attorney of any county, if you're sick or if you can't serve, let's say you've got a sick child maybe, and you whatever.
Or conflict of interest.
Totally. And that happens. You know, it's your kid who did something wrong. Or if you say, I've recused myself, and the statute says that you file a recusal in that case, then you get a special prosecutor. The court appoints a special prosecutor.
How do you think Kim Fox knew that process?
She's a lawyer.
I don't know but she was new to the office. And
hello?
Okay, all right, so you're not going to give her a pass on that?
Maybe
she doesn't deserve a pass on that. Somebody in the office should have said, hey, we've been here a while, here's how that happened.
Well, the other part of this is that recuse is not a word that you use in common parlance. When you're speaking to lawyers and you say, I recuse myself, we all know what that means. Lawyers know that means I am out, I am totally out, get it out of my office. I can't touch it anymore. And she said those words, did not do that, and then even under her own definition, continued to be involved in the case. And that's where you go, wait.
Right. Okay, well, and that's where we felt she was lying to us, right? Because mm-hmm. the fine point about the recusal process was lost in a lot of us, but we understood that to mean that she was no longer going to oversee the case, and yet it did seem as though the staff knew what her wishes were, and they were following her line, right?
Right, and it shouldn't have been in her office anyway.
What do you mean
all?
It shouldn't have been in her
the
office?
The minute she recuses herself, she is the state's attorney.
But she didn't recuse herself, right? I mean, technically she didn't recuse herself, did she?
Well, if you say, I recuse myself, that is known to most lawyers, I've recused myself. Now, you have a problem. If she says the word, I recuse myself to her staff, and then doesn't file it in the court file, and she didn't,
right.
Now you got another problem. You got a state's attorney who's saying one thing, not following through on paperwork. Then you've got a problem as well.
I guess as a technical matter, maybe she was, regardless of what she said, since she didn't go through the process, she was the attorney of record, if you will, for that case. But she's handing it off to her first lieutenant without doing it properly. So while he was now overseeing the case, he didn't have the authority to be overseeing the case.
Correct, because when you recuse yourself, it has to leave your office.
Yeah.
So that's where we are. And does that sound like a mess? Yes. It's not the way it's done.
So the remedy then is a special prosecutor is going to come in.
That's what the law says. Yeah, the remedy is a special prosecutor. And how do you get one of those?
Do we end up then answer that question?
That question, the statute says now Judge Tooman has to ask the public agencies in Illinois, and he has to ask the state attorney general and other local state's attorneys if they can volunteer to do this. Why? Because you don't want to have to spend money for a private attorney. And if somebody volunteers, he'll decide if those are good people. If nobody volunteers, then he has to appoint a private attorney to do it. And that, of course, involves expense for the county. And that's why you go to the government agencies first.
And I was talking to Megan Kripo, who wrote about this late last week in the Chicago Tribune. Even if there's no quote-unquote expense, it's a public official that'll oversee this case, that takes, you know, his time and staff away from something else. Ultimately, there could be some, if this was a private attorney, billable hours.
Correct.
There is an expense here, but you feel it's important enough to do what? Why just keep Smollett out of town? Why even go down this road?
Because the law provides for this. This is how the people of Illinois have governed these situations.
It's not about our feelings as Chicagoans?
No. It's not at all.
Just adherence to the law. You just
correct.
Want to see the I's dotted.
Yeah. It's the law, John. It's the law, John. And how did we all know this happened? I mean, I wasn't sitting at home watching the Jesse Smollett case step by step by step by step because I got other things to do. I mean, I was reading headlines.
Yeah.
But when you hear that this is a case in which the state's attorney said she was recused, and then one day we all wake up and the case has been dismissed, no notice to anybody, rushed into court, dismissed, totally dismissed, no plea taken, and the file is sealed. And another weird situation is he forfeited his bond. Well, where is that money going? Where is that money right now? He didn't plead guilty. Usually they can only take somebody's bond if they plead guilty. Where's the money?
So suppose that it was Kim Fox that cut that deal, the deal that you're talking about. Talk about that for a minute. What jumps out at you? Or is this the deal the janitor doesn't get at the courthouse as well? I mean, it was kind of weird, wasn't it?
It sounds weird. I mean, most of us have never seen a 16-count indictment just summarily dismissed, and without the state's attorney explaining to all of us why. Here's why I'm doing this, because you're the state's attorney. That's what is sticking out here. This is lack of transparency with the press, with the people of Cook County. Is why'd this happen? Well, what's going on? And without telling people what's going on, they're going to assume the worst, and the court file's sealed. And that's all. It just all coalesces into.
Why was that court file sealed?
Mr. Smollett made a motion because he had not pled and the cases were dismissed. He has the right to make that motion to seal the file. The state does not have to agree. It's my understanding the state did agree. Now, I
why did the state agree?
I don't know.
Why would the state agree?
I don't know.
Maybe. Why would the state agree?
I don't know. You tell me.
No, you have more knowledge about this sort of thing than I do.
No, I could be wrong. I don't know if the state. I'm pretty sure the state agreed. Why would you agree? And the statute for that says if there's objections to be heard, then, you know, this whole thing is a mess.
Well, then talk to me about this. I'm reading from the Tribune story. I think this is a Megan Kripo story, too.
By the way, great reporter.
Oh, yeah. You know
fabulous
what?
Reporter.
If you do not already, you should today subscribe to a newspaper. The likes of the Megan Kripos and the
Madeline
Stacey
Buckley's.
St. Clair's and the Madeline Buckley's. Those people every day go out there. They're paid a salary, which is might shock you. And for the people who say, oh, I get it free, or the Tribune's no good anymore, this kind of justice is not exacted, lest we have journalists out there digging the dirt.
And Megan Kripo, who's been following this, has been totally accurate in all her reporting, and more importantly, totally zeroes in into what's happening in that courtroom and gets the great tone. And so I big shout-outs to her.
Okay, so here's the reporting. The ruling marked a victory for Sheila O'Brien. That's you.
That's me.
A former state appellate judge who sought the special prosecutor in a largely solo effort. She had clashed with Judge Tooman, who had made it clear that he was the one still on the bench calling the shots.
Yes.
At least at the last hearing in May, Tooman cut down O'Brien's, that would be you's, attempts to boot Cook County prosecutors off of the case, denied her permission to take depositions of Fox and her top deputy, and rejected her multiple motions to transfer the case to another judge.
Yes.
Okay,
it was not a fun time.
Okay, talk about that time after this. An email has just poured in. Actually, it's a text message. It says, Judge, this would be to you. Two words, thank you. Aww. I so agree.
I agree.
What I've read about and witnessed about you, I'm like, you should run for office. Oh. You should be something. State's
I was
attorney.
Something.
Do you want it? You still are. And you know, you don't have to hold the title, I guess, to be an effective citizen.
Correct.
But your knowledge is paying great benefits to, I think, the city of Chicago, Judge Sheila O'Brien. Do you want to be state's attorney?
No.
You should be state's attorney.
No, that's not my skill set. That's a huge, huge
go be state's
job.
Attorney.
No.
Will Boston keep rolling, or will Abreu and the Southsiders stop the surging Sox, White Sox, Red Sox tonight at 6 on WGN-TV. We broadcast those games here on the radio, too, you know. The key to a good barbecue is preparation. You can never have too much ice. No one likes warm beer. Invest in one of those special candles to keep the mosquitoes away. With the steaks, thicker's better. The last step before the big barbecue, don't forget to call Deck Tech at 1-800-956-DECK or visit RestoreYourDeck.com. And for a limited time, receive a 10% discount when you mention this ad. Call 1-800-956-DECK or visit RestoreYourDeck.com. So she's a former appellate judge in Chicago, Judge Sheila O'Brien. She's in our studio. She's the one that just said, look, something's wrong here. And she was petitioning the court to appoint a special prosecutor over the Jussie Smollett case. She hasn't offered a strong opinion here about whether Jussie is telling the truth or not. That's not her point. She just doesn't think that justice was handled properly here. And so what do you know? We are going to get a special prosecutor. But this paragraph I read beforehand says that the judge, you were a pain in the judge's butt, it sounds like, the whole time. At the last hearing in May, Tooman cut down O'Brien's attempts to boot the prosecutors off the case, denied her permission to take depositions of Kim Fox. That would have been logical. And her top deputy, especially him, because she just threw him under the bus, and rejected her multiple motions to transfer the case to another judge. Why all the animosity between you and Judge Tooman?
That's not animosity, I don't think. That's not personal. That's court. He didn't think those were the way to handle it, and he denied them. So I don't feel like we had a big fight.
Had a disagreement.
And no, it's court, though. You're in court and you disagree.
Okay, I'm not saying you're taking it personally, but yeah. I mean, you felt like you had a point here.
I did, and
you weren't doing this just to get under anybody's nerves.
No. I really did want to get the depositions of certain people. I thought that made more sense, and I think Judge Tooman thought, let's just go on what we already have. And that's my sense of it now.
Okay, but I'm a little curious about that. It would seem to me like you would want a deposition of Kim Fox and her top deputy.
Joe Maggots.
Yeah. In fact, we haven't heard much from him since then. She kept saying, well, that he did that, he did that, he did that. And we said, well, why did he do that? And she said, well, you'll have to ask him. And we called him. He said, no, I can't do that. I'm not going to talk to you guys about that.
But now there is a special prosecutor, and that person will get a chance to talk to Joe Maggots.
And so does this mean that Jussie Smollett may ultimately go to jail?
Could. The case is going to be reopened. And
do you have an opinion about what the outcome of all of this should be?
Whether Mr. Smollett should go to jail or not? No, because I have not read all the police reports and haven't talked to the police officers and haven't looked at the physical evidence and haven't looked at his record or anything. That's my answer, yeah.
And he might claim, I know it's not, but I could see how he would think like this is double jeopardy. Like, hey, you guys had a crack at me. You decided not to prosecute me. You let me go. And now what? Because it's politically inconvenient, you're going to try it again?
Well, the question of jeopardy attaching, usually jeopardy attaches when you do something on that case itself. And here, nothing was done on that case. It was just dismissed. So it appears, at least from the way I was practiced law, that jeopardy didn't attach. And Mr. Smollett can be
I understand
charged.
That. And one last thing then about Kim Fox. I mean, your problem wasn't with the judge per se. It was more with Kim Fox's office. Do you have an opinion about Kim Fox's stewardship of that office right now?
Look, I don't know her. I've never met her. But this was not her finest hour, I don't think. And this was very, very troubling. And this is very basic. Transparency, truth, openness. Everybody gets treated fairly. Everybody gets treated the same. This was a very odd disposition on a 16-count indictment for a television star. I think the other thing that your followers know, too, is that this case happened 2 weeks after the college admission scandal situation broke. People trying to get cuts in line, rich people trying to do things they shouldn't do because they're rich and powerful. I think that's part of it. You know, you see that when people are trying to get cuts in line, it just bothers you.
Well, there were some big names that sort of populated this case, that's for sure.
Right. So there's, and the college admission scandal, the same thing. And people don't like that. It's not fair is all in us as Americans.
One quick question here. Yeah. We're out of time. We're past out of time. Jim, what did you want to say? You're on here.
I was just wondering if the special investigator process is going to be a Cook County judge or a Cook County even investigator prosecutor outside Cook County.
Yeah, good question.
Probably outside, or somebody who's already working in the Attorney General's office. It would be from another government entity at first, but most possibly outside of Cook.
Oh, and hopefully not this Attorney General's. Well, no. I mean, it would seem to me like we should establish as much distance as we can.
I would vote for that, yeah.
But that has not been determined.
We don't know yet.
They didn't ask
for
your opinion
right,
on this.
And they got to see who volunteers to
do it. Could you be the special investigator on this?
Yeah, you know, that's a really interesting question. I was on John Cass's podcast this morning, and he asked me who I liked, and she'll kill me. The woman I used to be with at the appellate court, who was a former ASA and one of the greatest prosecutors ever. And boy, she's retired.
Who's this?
Her name's Peggy Frisard. She's going to be so mad at me. But Peggy Frisard, she did the Gary Dotson case for Rich Daley.
Yeah, wow.
And she is one great prosecutor.
Well, she doesn't have to do it, but that's your recommendation.
I'd love it.
Do you have the skill set? Would you be a logical person for this?
No, I don't think that's my skill set. I mean, I can try cases. I was a public defender, however. But someone like someone like her, she was fabulous.
We're out of time. Could I call you again? To
absolutely, it'd be fun.
Comment
Thank
on
you.
This or other
sure.
things.
Absolutely,
Judge
lots
Sheila
of fun.
O'Brien is the Illinois Appellate Court Justice, former, who had a lot to do with where we are today on the Smollett case. It's 2:32. Okay, into the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. Steve's got the news. Then we visit with brewers from the Englewood neighborhood. You heard me right, Steve. A text is poured into the show. Hey, King John, do you want to play handyman poker? I replace the start cable on on my lawnmower this weekend.
Impressive.
We have not played handyman poker in a very long time.
It's too bad for you, too, or it's actually too good for you because I've been doing some pretty good stuff.
Oh, I was just thinking, oh, we'll play handyman poker. Let's play it tomorrow. Handyman poker is a game we play where we all brag about all of the chores we did around the house over the weekend.
What's our window?
You mean Monday, Tuesday?
I mean, does it have to be over last weekend?
Well, you were gone.
I mean, I could still beat you just with last weekend.
Well, I don't know. I would say
I was only home half a weekend, and I'll still beat you.
I fixed our beds, our box springs.
Enough said.
That's a thing that you don't normally get a chance to do.
What did you do? Cut it open and respring the bed, or what exactly does that mean?
Well, let's play handyman poker and see who is the handiest over a weekend.
Okay.
Not right now. We'll do it tomorrow. And I think we should include, on occasion, a listener's handyman or woman venture.
A few weeks ago, I replaced an outdoor electrical outlet.
Wow.
And I suggested that we play, and you didn't. Which
perhaps I was busy that day.
Unfair.
This one says we replaced the start cable on my lawnmower.
It's not bad.
That's pretty good. That's pretty good. I don't know that it will win handyman poker. We'll play the game tomorrow, especially because it's got a pretty snappy jingle, and that's half the reason I want to play it. So we'll do that then. By the way, there's some people that just strolled into our studio. And thanks again to Judge Sheila O'Brien for coming into our studio and catching us up on the Jussie Smollett case, which will never go away. 1,000 years from now, people will still be going, well, I don't think he was telling the truth. Or I think he was. And what about that Kim Fox? So you haven't heard the last of that. In our studio, though, setting up right now are Leslie Roth and Steve Marchese. They are the co-founders of the Inglewood Brews, which is, if I understand correctly, a new craft beer being brewed in Chicago. But this one, not on the north side, not in Lincoln Square, Lincoln Park, or over by Wrigley. This one is not in Ravenswood. It's in Inglewood, if I understand correctly. So let's welcome them into the studio. Leslie, how are you?
Good. Thanks for having us today.
And Steve, the same to you.
Thank you for having us.
Am I right about that? Inglewood's the neighborhood that it's physically in?
I rode the train there from this morning.
What's the address?
The address is 821 West 63rd. It's right at the intersection of 63rd and Halsted.
What is the demographic makeup of Inglewood?
The demographic makeup of Inglewood is primarily African-American. As you know, it's on the south side of Chicago. It's about 9-ish miles away from downtown. What's really exciting about its location, it's kind of the gateway to Chicago. It's about 5 miles from Midway Airport and about another 7 miles to the lakefront. So down the 63rd Street corridor, it's a historic corridor in Chicago. 63rd and Halsted used to be the second highest grossing retail commercial node in the city.
Really?
Second only to Michigan in the first half of the 20th
right.
century. So
really?
We're really excited to be a part of this historic trajectory.
But today it's an African-American community and also a poor community, and those aren't two of the bellwethers of craft brew, you know, drinkers, right? I mean, that's not the audience I would logically think one would go after. Is that the audience you're going after,
Absolutely.
The local neighborhood?
So craft beer is actually, and microbreweries have been known to be economic generators in neighborhoods. And part of the vision for our microbrewery is revitalization, is creative placemaking, is celebration of arts and culture in a community that, you know, has historically had some ups and downs. So we're excited to be a part of a restorative future.
Is that it? Is it a love of beer, or is it more a cause for you?
I think it's both. I mean, love of beer is important. It's always been a uniter of people. And so we see that as being really important. But the cause is equally important. You know, we founded the brewery with the idea of making a difference. And I think that beer plays an important part in helping to push that along.
Is that your background, beer? Are you a brewer?
I'm a brewer. I started off in home brewing like a lot of people did.
No kidding.
Yep.
I know so many guys who did that. And then they'd walk around with the bottles to the neighbors, and we'd all try it. It was all pretty good.
Right.
But yep. It never went anywhere.
For a lot of people, it stays a hobby. For other people, it becomes an obsession and a passion.
And that was you, huh?
Yeah.
Right. So is this your first beer, or have you brewed other beers?
I did a short stint of professional brewing in Milwaukee back in the 90s. Also made an attempt to open one with another partner back then. But being young people in a different kind of climate of understanding about what craft beer was, it never really quite took
off. So how did the two of you connect then?
So we both have worked in Englewood for many years. Steve and I have both been in Chicago for over 20 years. My background is architecture and urban planning, and Steve's is nonprofit management, training, and energy efficiency. So what was exciting about the opportunity to open up Englewood Brews is that it's not only a production facility, but it's also a tap room. So as Steve mentions, you know, the beers that we're brewing, part of that is socializing, you know, the story behind the beers, being able to name the beers after Englewood destinations, people, places, past events, and the future of it, and really share that. And so people begin to, like you, start to gain that knowledge about beer, how it's made, and how to be a better taster.
Half the fun will be designing the can. I mean, when you look at craft brews these days, the cans are outrageous, and the names are bizarre. Have you come up with your artwork or all of the brew names?
Brew names are always kind of in transition, and we've got a whole bunch of them. We like to stick with what we call Englewood mythology, so people and places, events, things that are important to the area, to the local area. The artwork, obviously, it's going to feature our logo, which listeners can't see right here. Can always see it online.
But I'm looking at white letters on a blue T-shirt with the W looking like a stalk of grain or something.
Exactly, right.
Yeah.
Listeners can go to EnglewoodBrews.com or follow us at EnglewoodBrews on Instagram.
Yeah, can I buy the beer right now?
No.
I can't get a growler or
anything?
We're
not licensed to sell beer yet. We still have to go through that process.
Yeah.
And part of that's dependent on actually building the brewery, which is up and coming for us.
But what do you have in front of you?
So these are prototype beers that we make as homebrew right now.
Can I try one?
Of course.
Okay, so what have you got here?
This is...
These are prototypes, so you don't know if these will, in fact, be brewed or sold at your brewery?
They're likely to be there in some form or fashion. This is a German-inspired Munich Helles lager, so it's light and approachable.
I was just going to say, I'm not a big fan of the lagers. My son had one this weekend. I took a sip of it and passed.
Oh.
This is so much lighter than the one he had.
Mm-hmm.
What am I tasting? Is the lack of alcohol by volume, or?
Not necessarily. It's the malts that we use, so it's brewed almost exclusively with
this is nice,
German
though.
Pilsner malt.
This is really different, though. Mm-hmm. I mean, it tastes like a lager, but it's much lighter than the lagers I've tasted.
Right.
This would be nice in the summertime.
Exactly. We call it Sherman's Picnic Lager.
Oh, here we go. Sherman's Picnic Lager.
Named after Sherman Park. Mr. Sherman, the founder or the namesake of the park.
Not the Sherman in the Civil War Sherman.
No, Sherman was, Sherman. This was actually Daniel Burnham, the father of Chicago, his father-in-law, who was a philanthropist and really believed that when this park was built, it was actually designed by Frederick Law Olmsted, who also, as you know, had a huge impact on the South Side of Chicago, the 1893 World's Fair. And he believed that the South Side of Chicago should have wide open spaces, and that's why he wanted Frederick Law Olmsted to design that park. So in Englewood, there's actually some really gorgeous parks. There's beautiful field houses. And so this beer is actually part of that mythology named after Sherman.
You know, I don't remember. I've talked about Englewood a lot, maybe more than the two of you know, because I did a lot of volunteer work at a school down there. Several years ago, I was in Chicago, I was on the radio here, and that was my cause, was this one school in Englewood. I've moved away, and I haven't reconnected with them since I've come back. But my point is this, that when we think about Englewood, we mostly just hear bad stories. I don't remember the last time I've talked about Englewood this way, you know, about the history, about the architecture, about a craft brew, for crying out loud.
That's an important fact that has to change. You know, Englewood is not just about the scary stuff that is always splashed across the news. It's about, like every other neighborhood in Chicago, the people that are there, their stories, and their lives.
And now I'm here. Now I'm learning a little history of Chicago I didn't know about, that settled in Englewood and maybe a little further east. But that's Chicago. We should know these stories. So and if a beer made that happen, it's a win-win as I'm concerned.
Like I said, it gets the conversation going.
It really does. So the name of this one will be?
Sherman's Picnic Lager.
Sherman's Picnic Lager. Now, is that the same one you have there in front of you?
Yeah, that's the same beer here.
Got anything else?
I've got a couple more.
Now, Jay, get in here. We need to start popping some beers. Jay's not 21, but I am. So if you've got something else for us
to try, really liked your response to the first beer. One of the things that we try to do and what we thought about in doing our tastings and writing our business plan and, you know, having tasting parties is we wanted to brew beer that was very approachable, that would be enjoyable for craft beer aficionados and enthusiasts, as well as those that are just getting into craft beer and just learning about it.
I like this one even better. What do I be drinking here?
This is our take on a pale ale.
Yeah, sure it is.
Yeah. So the name for this beer is still to be decided, to be honest with you. We're still working on the name for this beer.
But you don't have a name for this beer?
No. We've
How been, much fun is that? We should do a contest. You should do a thing online.
Well, we've got to reserve some things like that.
Well, so how do we describe this? Kind of hoppy and...
It's like your standard pale ale. It's going to be have a nice malt backbone to match a more aggressive hop profile. And it's hopped with the standard, you know, Citra and Cascade hops.
Citra, what does that mean?
Citra is a type of hop.
As in citrus?
Its name kind of implies the citrus notes and overtones.
Because
that
that's where they play with a lot of those beers, is how citrusy do they want it to be? Do you want a grapefruit kind of sting to it or not? And and everybody's got their... And that seems to be where a lot of those go. It's not my cup of tea. I prefer them to be more on the hoppy side and less citrusy tasting. But, you know, don't brew it for me. Brew it for what you think's going to work. This, to me, kind of cuts the middle on those. I would run away from a citrusy ale, pale ale, but this just has a hint of that. I don't know if I'm describing the beer the way you intended to brew it.
Absolutely, yeah.
I have a good palate, evidently. About
you've
beers.
Got a great palate.
And maybe there's something for me with you guys, you know, as an official taster or something. I don't know.
Right.
Absolutely. You seem like a professional. There, you know, that's a part of the fun of designing these beers, is that it is a creative endeavor. You know, looking at the different tasting profiles, looking at the different ingredients. I mean, there's only four basic ingredients that go into these beers, but there's a million different variations. And so what we're looking for is a variety of beer styles. Of malt compositions, of hop compositions that are really going to have not only a delicious flavor, but kind of fill out a whole pantheon of enjoyability and what people actually like when they walk into the tap room. The other thing is that these beers pair really well with food.
That's the tricky part.
Absolutely.
Is knowing.
Yep. And that's why we've done a lot of research into that. It always, you know, beer pairs very well with food. And so we're looking at how we're going to do that in the tap room. We're not doing a full kitchen. We're going to have food trucks and a whole variety of other food options.
This is so ambitious and such a good idea. And I'm so rooting for Inglewood this way.
Great.
I mean, for you guys, the brewers, but also for that neighborhood. What a fun destination that would be for people to try this one out. And then I guess in a perfect world, maybe other bars carry it. It's in stores, that sort of thing.
Absolutely.
I mean,
yeah.
What's the model you would like to, say, follow for a craft brew? Another name I'd recognize that you want to be the next.
Oh, another brewer that's out there that...
You want a model.
Many, many of them are doing the same model. So, I couldn't just pick out any.
But the one I just described, you maybe had some stuff. You tried it. It worked well. Now it's good locally. Now other places carry it. Next thing you know, you're Lagunitas or something like that.
That would be great if we could get to that point. I think that our investors would love that.
Well, you're two for two as far as I'm concerned.
Great.
Let me just sample one more here. What are we drinking
so
now?
So the third one that I poured for you is probably the most hop-forward beer that we make. We call it Bucket of Parrots. It's named after the big green parrots that you see in various places in the South Side.
Bucket of Parrots.
Bucket
what
of Parrots.
Great name. What fun.
Thank you, yeah. So this one is inspired to be more tropical flavored and, you know, and just kind of a fun beer. It draws some inspiration from some of those tropical flavors that you would get out of the New England IPA style. But... intentionally tried to make the beer clearer, which I think is important for
all
a beer.
Of these are clearer.
Yeah, I really like clear looking beers. To me, that's a mark of, you know, quality, and
it's kind of a golden color.
Yeah, it's got a
and
nice
why is it called Bucket of Parrots?
Because it's silly.
Yeah. There's a family of parrots that live in Inglewood, big green parrots, and there's
it's like
a family
59th
and
Morgan, I think.
Really?
Yep.
Yeah.
There's a family of them in Hyde Park too. But we thought it would be fun to brew a tropical beer that was reminiscent of, you know, this kind of, you know, somebody's pet that got let go and is now has a home
a
there.
Family.
Leslie Roth, Steve Marchese are in our studio. We got to wrap this up now. The same time's up, so I have to let you go. But when would be the next time to have you guys back in the studio? Then
we'd love to come back and see you. We're launching a crowdsource campaign later this summer. You can look on the website for that, and then towards the end of the year when we start construction, we have an open date. That would be great.
All three of them are a little lighter in touch, and I like that too.
It's intentional. We really want to have beers that are lighter and approachable.
John, why is it so many of the weird names can be either a craft beer, a racehorse, or a band playing at Lollapalooza? That's true. They all seem to be, as he said, silly and fun. Congratulations already.
Thank you.
I'm telling you,
so
those are three good brews by me. And let's help this thing down the road as well.
Thanks so much. We're really excited to represent the South Side.
What's the website?
The website is www.inglewoodbrews.com.
Nice to see you both.